Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Tuesday, September 2nd, 2014. And I'm doing this show on my own today. I'm going to answer some questions that you guys have sent me in my newsletter, the Tom Woods Letter. I put out a request some time ago for questions. I said, what would you guys think if I had a Q&A episode once in a while? And I was thinking of actually having it as a bonus episode, as a supplement to the other episodes. Someday, when things calm down for me, I do intend to do it that way. But for now, I'm going to do it as a show in the five-day-a-week rotation. Once in a while, I'll take some of your questions so you can submit them at the contact page. I don't think the radio page, the podcast page, has a contact tab. I don't know what that means. I think that means leave me alone or something. It sends a very bad message. You can contact me after all, it turns out. Over at tomwoods.com, you'll see a contact page. That reaches me just like an email. So you shouldn't feel like if I type something into this thing, it's going to disappear into the ether and no one's ever going to see it. No, it comes to me instantly as an email. So I will read your question. Now, I may not be able to answer your question. I may not know the answer to your question. And in some cases, I may try to get a guest on if the question is of general interest, and I feel that a lot of listeners would be interested in the answer. I'll try and bring a guest on, because a lot of times listener questions give me good ideas for guests. So I'll try and bring a guest on and answer that question, or I'll try and answer some of them myself. So I do have a question involving publishing, and when I get to that one, I'll talk to you about my forthcoming book, because the pre-order page, at least for the Kindle edition, is already up on Amazon. And soon the paperback edition pre-order page will be up and the audiobook page. And by the way, I'm reading the audiobook myself. I generally don't like the people they choose to read my books for audiobooks, but that's not a decision that I make. That's a publisher's decision. Generally, publishers don't have the author read the book. And the reason for that, I think, I don't know this for sure, but I strongly suspect, is that authors are not necessarily good public speakers. They may get in front of a microphone, even with no audience, even just in a studio somewhere, and just trip over their words or not articulate well, and they'd rather just have a professional do it who can get it done in a minimum number of hours and be done with it. But I generally have not been happy, particularly, I think, the Politically Incorrect Guide to American History. Oh my gosh, why? Why is the guy trying to make you fall asleep? I don't know. What's interesting to me, though, is that for Meltdown and Nullification, I had the same audiobook reader, and I'm sorry his name's escaping me right now, but I got a wonderful note from him after he read Meltdown. He emailed me spontaneously. He's a professional. He had just finished doing Chuck Norris's audiobook for whatever book he had out, and he wrote to say, you know, I got your book in the mail, and I thought to myself, oh, great, another right-wing screed. But after I read it, I thought to myself, well, doggone it, this guy's got some good points. And he wrote to say, do you think there is any prospect of the Austrian approach to this really starting to gain the upper hand in policy circles? Now, this is a guy who told me he had voted for Obama. But all he had to do was read through Meltdown, and his mind started to change. Then he read Nullification. So now I'm making the guy's head explode completely. He reads Nullification, he writes to me and says, you know, I think you make some good points here. I think the states do need to have a role in things. So that's great. You know, that is wonderful. But as I say, I'm going to enjoy reading this, although it's going to take a lot longer than you think. Can you imagine a 350-page book reading that thing? It's going to take me a long time, and I've got to have that ready in time for the book release date. You know, wasn't I supposed to talk about this book when I got to the publishing question? I'm sorry. I will talk more about it then, but the release date is September 29th, and I'm going to be out of town from the 21st through the 26th, so that really limits the amount of time I can spend on the audiobook, so I'm going to try and get started on it tomorrow, and we'll just hope we can get that up there on Amazon ASAP. Remember, of course, that people supporting this show at supportinglisteners.com, all of you guys will get the Kindle version of the book. And the Kindle version in some ways is superior to the paper edition because it's got hyperlinks in it that are clickable. Obviously, how are you going to click something on a piece of paper? And the hyperlinks help to develop some of the arguments in the book. They'll take you to pages of mine with more information, or when I'm critiquing an article, there'll be a you can press the button and read the original article. So it is kind of intended as an ebook, but the paper edition is going to be very handsome, and I'm very pleased with it as well. All right, let's get into the questions. The first one, it's kind of a long question. I'm just going to summarize it. The question is, supposing I agree with the Austrian contention that any supply of money is optimal, and that is the Austrian view, any supply of money is optimal in the sense that any supply of money can facilitate as many transactions as the economy needs. You just let prices fall to whatever level is necessary. So if I've got an economy and there are $10 in the whole economy, and we've got two transactions to be made, well, it's not like if the amount of money in the economy somehow fell to $5 because somebody lost a $5 bill or burned it or ate it or something, then we would only be able to have one transaction now. The number of transactions would be cut in half because the amount of money would be cut in half. No, they wouldn't. You just have the transactions take place at lower prices. You know, the average price would now be $2.50 per purchase instead of $5 per purchase, and you can still clear the market, make all the transactions you need to make. I mean, that's the answer that David Ricardo gave 200 years ago to this question. Even though you do get that a lot, right? We need the money supply to grow so we can facilitate all these transactions and all this and that. Okay, but we don't. So what the questioner is asking, though, is that if that's true, that any amount of money can allow for the whatever number of transactions is necessary in the economy, why in a fully free economy with no government involvement whatsoever, with money provided by private enterprise, why would they ever need to create more money? Why would they ever need to produce more coins? And that's a good question. He's saying, wouldn't it be socially wasteful for a private firm to produce more money if we never need more money? What possible reason would society have for the creation of additional money by a private firm? And the answer basically is this. It has to do with optimal coin size. So let's suppose we're talking about silver coins, let's say. The idea of the reason that the market chooses a particular thing to be money is that it meets certain requirements that people have for money, that it's durable, it's valuable per unit weight, it's divisible, it's easily identifiable, all these sorts of characteristics. So it has to be relatively scarce or it wouldn't have been chosen as a money in the first place. So it's going to be something that's scarce. It's going to be something that isn't going to be created anew in huge quantities. There aren't going to be huge quantities of it coming onto the market, or it wouldn't have been chosen as a money in the first place. It's precisely because the commodity that the market chooses as a money is not highly volatile. It's not constantly increasing in supply or suddenly decreasing. It tends to be stable, although not absolutely the same all the time. That's why the market chooses it. Now, think about what that means. If the money is going to be basically stable or increasing in quantity only very slightly over time, and this is one of the reasons we like it as a money, then what's going to happen to prices over time? The other goods and services in the economy will continue to grow. In a progressing economy, we get more and more of pretty much everything. But the amount of money is not going to keep pace with that. And that's fine. That's how we want it. The amount of money is going to stay the same or increase very slightly. So what does that mean? Well, just do the ratio in your head. The number of goods other than money explodes, relatively speaking. Money stays roughly the same, so any one unit of money is now going to command more and more goods. So each money unit is going to grow more and more valuable. Now, it could get to a point, this process, that each unit of money gets so valuable that like one atom of silver could buy you a Cadillac, at which point this would not be a useful money. I mean, at that point, probably the market would just, it would be so bad, the market would shift into a different kind of money altogether. But now we see the social value of increasing the number of coins simply because it maintains the preferred coin size of the public. The public does not want to have to deal with subatomic particles or doesn't want to deal with let's say, coins that are the size of your shirt button. They'd rather have a coin, as indicated by their preferences, that is, I don't know, maybe the size of a quarter or whatever. And the point is that as the money gets more valuable, which happens in a free economy because production of all other goods increases, the money stays roughly the same, a coin that's the size of a quarter will, you know, would buy you, you know, 10 planets or something. So the idea is that the coin size will tend to get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, but people don't want it to be that small. And so the introduction of new supplies of money means that the coin size can fight back against this trend and eventually reach a point at which the coin size is roughly where people want it and the money is optimal from the point of view of the consumer using it. I hope that was sort of clear. It's a technical question regarding coin size, and that is a reason that we would want some additional precious metals minted, for, just for that reason, for the convenience of holding the coins in a size that is satisfies consumer preferences. All right, this is a question from a Topeka high school student. I live here in Topeka, so this is very interesting. I'll read this to you. I'm a high school junior in some high school here in Topeka. We won't say exactly which Topeka high school it is. And for all I know, there's only one. Like, I don't even know, right? I don't even know. Don't even look. All right. I'm founder slash president of the Young Libertarians Club here. I'm an avid reader of Rothbard, Mises, and Hayek. Could you imagine being a high school junior and having your head screwed on this well already? This amazes me. I was at that time in my life, I was cheering on George H.W. Bush against Michael Dukakis. That was about the level of my knowledge, with Ron Paul running as a libertarian, and I don't even know what's going on with that. So she's got two questions here. How does an ideal libertarian society deal with the issue of taxation? Given that taxation is legalized theft, but minarchy still requires a government with resources, how is this reconciled without sacrificing libertarian ideals and adherence to the non-aggression axiom? All right, very, very good question. Good grief. Wow, that's a good question, especially for a high school junior. Holy cow, that's great. All right, well, here I think is the answer. This is my answer, right? Maybe you have your own answer, but this is my answer. My answer is those things can't be reconciled. And this tends to be the thing that takes people from minarchism to private property anarchism or anarcho-capitalism, is that they feel like, I can't justify taxation even for things government really, really supposedly needs. And I realize that really I'm just doing what the other side is doing. They want to tax for things that they think are important, and I want to tax for things that I think are important. Well, how is that qualitatively different? Isn't that just the same thing? And isn't taxation a form of aggression, even if it funds things that we all think are important? Like, is it really consistent to say, well, taxation is theft after a certain point, but up to a certain point, taxation is absolutely necessary and you should be thrown in jail if you don't consent to it? That doesn't seem quite right to me. That doesn't seem quite right. It doesn't seem consistent. So it seems to me if you're going to say the non-aggression principle has to be abided by at all times and in all places, then you have to follow it to its logical consequence, which would be you can't support taxation. Now, one way around this, attempted way around this, is the Randian objectivist solution, which is to say that the government should be funded voluntarily. And that would be one way out of this, that, look, if people really think its services are valuable, they'll donate to them in the same way that they donate huge amounts to other things they think are valuable. So donations. But Rothbard pointed out that this is still not a purely free solution because it takes for granted that there's a monopolistic provider of certain services and you're donating to it. Well, what if I open up my own defense agency and my own courts and whatever? The government would not let me do that. Even though it would be funded voluntarily, the government would be funded voluntarily, so you wouldn't have the aggression of taxation. You would have the aggression of a monopoly because it would stop me from setting up my own competing services. So there's still coercion involved, even when you say, let's have taxation be voluntary. So I don't think it can be reconciled. So I think what a minarchist has to say is, I generally believe in the non-aggression principle, but I think for practical reasons, I have to suspend it up to a point. And if people want to have that view, you know, that's a point of view. But I'm just telling you what that means to me. Now, by the way, I generally don't pick fights with Minerkas just because I feel like I find it highly doubtful that I'm ever going to be in a situation in which I'm actually faced with those two choices. And so do I want to spend my time on Earth arguing with people who agree with me on 95% of things? Is that really the most productive use of my time? Sometimes I bring guests on here to make those people think, but that's really as far as I want to go. I'm not going to lose friendships over this, for heaven's sake. All right, second question. Given that a government is founded by the willful consent of the people under the social contract to protect life, liberty, and property, which it can do better than individuals can do themselves, what if a single individual decides he does not agree with this form of government and doesn't give his consent to be governed by it? How would a minarchist libertarian society deal with this situation, say, regarding an anarchist? All right, well, there are a lot of premises here. The idea that a government is founded by the willful consent of the people under the social contract, I don't believe that. I think that's a fantasy. That's a problem right there. That's a huge assumption. And we talked about that in my program I did with Mike Huemer of the University of Colorado at Boulder, H-U-E-M-E-R. I strongly urge that you Google Tom Woods Show and Michael Huemer, H-U-E-M-E-R. In fact, I liked the interview I did with him so much that I reproduced the text of it in my forthcoming book that's coming out later this month, September 2014. And he addresses some of these theoretical points. Then, which it can do, and I, by the way, I have a video on this too. I think it's called When Did I Sign This Social Contract? So you might want to look at that on YouTube. Then, which it can do better than individuals can do themselves. I think this is more assertion than proof, especially today. I think it's quite possible to imagine that individuals could provide for the things they need better than government services can. I think we have this romanticized view of the military and of the police that is increasingly being shown to be unjustified. So what if a single individual decides, look, I don't give my consent? All right, so that goes to show there really can't have been a social contract, right? A social contract, if it's going to be truly social, has to involve all of society. So if a single individual says, I'm not going to go along with this, what would people do? All right. Well, in a minarchist society, I think they would have to coerce him, because a minarchist society does believe that some taxes are necessary. And if one person says, I'm not going to pay, then everybody else is going to say they're not going to pay. So I think they would have to use coercion against him. So I think this poses another problem for minarchism. And incidentally, Stephen Kinsella has a good point about minarchism. He says, look at the U.S. Constitution. It doesn't even call for some of the minimal things that a minarchist believes in. A minarchist thinks that the government needs to provide you with courts, needs to provide you with military defense, needs to provide you with police services. But the U.S. Constitution does not provide for police services. That's supposed to be dealt with at another level. It does not provide for police services. It does provide for a military, but the federal court system is not particularly elaborate in the Constitution. And yet, here you have a government that has now become so huge that we have no idea what to do with it, and it started off with powers less than what a minarchist would give to a government. So it is interesting to think about. Okay, thanks for those questions. Let's move on. I've got a question here about publishing and what my advice is on publishing and what my experiences have been. Oh, I don't know. I mean, I feel like maybe I could do a whole show on that. Maybe I should do a show on that. How about that? Maybe a show on... But I don't know. Does anybody care? I don't know. It's my show, right? I can just talk about it. And if people care, they can listen in. Maybe I'll do a show on publishing. Maybe I'll do that tomorrow. Who knows? Okay, next question. I am a recipient of the fairy tale version of American history, and now I continue to be amazed at what I was not taught, and so on and on. He's talking about the Constitutional Convention. One book I read characterized it as a bloodless coup. And then he wants to know, what do I think about this? If I were living then, he assumes I would have become an anti-federalist, and so on. Okay, well, we'll say a little something about this. I don't know. I haven't seen real smoking gun evidence. Although I do think it's likely that people who had their own agendas did want to see the Constitutional Convention take place, or we call it the Philadelphia Convention, take place and strengthen the central government. There was a book written in the early 20th century, An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution, something like that, by Charles Beard, in which he looked at some of the records and said, if you look at the people supporting the Constitution, these are by and large heavy bondholders who are concerned that under the current regime, the bonds will not be redeemed at face value, and they don't want their portfolio of bonds to be rendered worthless. So they want a government that will have the power to make sure that these bonds are paid, that the federal government will have the power to take over the payment of the bonds from the states, which are in some cases thought to be unreliable in repaying them, and to make sure that they are paid at par, at the face value. Now then, years later, a historian named Forrest MacDonald wrote a book called We the People, and I don't recall the subtitle, and he went back with more documentation than Charles Beard had access to and said that really there's nothing to the Beard explanation. There's no connection there at all. And then since then, there have been historians who say, well, it's neither as open and shut as Beard said or as open and shut as MacDonald says. So it's at this point, it is hard to assess that. But it does seem likely that people had vested interests in having a stronger central government. What matters, though, is what did they wind up producing? There were people who showed up who wanted a fully nationalist system where the legislature would have plenary authority to govern in a wide variety of unspecified areas. That's not what they got. So it doesn't matter, like anything that you might read about people conniving about, I hope we get this type of government or that type of government or this is what I favor, none of that matters. What matters is what did they wind up with? And what were the people sold in the ratifying conventions? And there, in the ratifying conventions, it's clear that the new government was not a national government. It was a federal government with enumerated powers, not plenary powers, not powers over all things. And the only restrictions would be ones that are expressly spelled out. No, the federal government's powers are only the ones that are expressly spelled out. They have only the powers that are expressly spelled out. Limitations are assumed on anything that's not spelled out. And that's clear in the ratifying convention. So that's what matters. That's what they got. It doesn't matter what people were conniving about, what they were plotting about. What matters was the outcome, what actually happened, and what was sold to the people at the ratifying conventions. Now, would I have been an anti-federalist? Well, sure, I wouldn't have wanted the additional centralization of power. And it's so funny. I remember checking on Facebook, well, this is probably 4 years ago, if you go to U.S. Constitution, there's a page on Facebook for U.S. Constitution, and it's got, you know, 8 million likes. Everybody loves the Constitution. Then you go to the Articles of Confederation, and it was like 350 likes. Absolutely bizarre, because I mean, it can't possibly be that obvious that the one is to be preferred to the other, right? I mean, obviously there's something to be said for the Articles of Confederation, but we have all gotten in school this idea that the Articles were stupid and the Constitution was a progressive step forward. And everyone has so obediently absorbed that that the old document doesn't even get it. I mean, it can't get as many likes as, like, I don't know. I'm trying to look at an object on my desk that would get fewer likes than the Articles of Confederation. I can't find one. It's bizarre. If you look at, I mean, I talked about this, and I'll be talking a little bit about this when I do my U.S. Constitution course for the Ron Paul Homeschool Program, ronpaulhomeschool.com. The Constitution course will be, I'll be starting in on that in the fall of 2015. But it turns out that when you look at testimonies on the eve of the Philadelphia Convention, you do find some people saying, well, things are terrible because of the Articles. But you find other people saying things are fine. The economy's fine. All kinds of things are fine. And if the economy was bad or people were struggling, that could have a little something to do with they had just fought a war against the strongest power in the world. Well, yeah, maybe the states would have trouble paying the federal government or the government of the Articles what it was demanding. Well, maybe that's because they're impoverished from war. I mean, that could have a little something to do with it. The amount of money being demanded from the states was more money than was in existence in the territory of what would later become the United States, the entire territory. So maybe the demands were a little bit unreasonable. So there are testimonies that things were good. There are testimonies that things were bad. And as I say, if the central government was having trouble getting money from the states, It might simply be that the states were impoverished, as some people noted at the time. They didn't have that much money. And as I say, they were being asked for more money than existed, so this might be a bit of an issue. All right, I can't believe where the time has gone here. I do want to say a little something about my new book. It's called Real Dissent, A Libertarian Sets Fire to the Index Card of Allowable Opinion. And if any of you guys have ever read my replies to critics, not necessarily critics of me personally, but critics of libertarian ideas, if you enjoy some of those replies, well, this book brings a lot of those together. That's not what the whole book is about, but it brings a lot of those together. I think you'll like it. I put an image of the cover in my newsletter, which you can sign up for at tomwoods.com. I send it out every week and just updating people on what I'm doing. And so I had that. I have the 10 parts that the book is divided into. And basically, it's taking on a lot of the issues that need to be talked about, that are talked about in really narrow, along a very narrow spectrum. So war, the Federal Reserve, the economy, and many, many other topics. I have a whole section on Ron Paul and his significance, why he matters to history, why he's a significant historical figure that you will find punchy, I assure you. So this brings together a lot of stuff that I've done over the years, but I think when you put it together, it is a really enjoyable bunch of things to read. Like some of these things I haven't seen in a while, and when I was looking at them, I thought, you know, this is a lot better than I remember it. So I hope you guys enjoy it. I'll have more to say about it as the pre-order pages become available. There is already a pre-order page for the Kindle version. I'm trying out self-publishing on this, by the way, before I forget. I've never done that before. I've had some great publishers in the past. I've had Regnery, which has been around since 1947. I've had Random House, which is huge. I've had Basic Books, which is huge. I've had Lexington Books / Roman and Littlefield, which is a very good academic publisher. I've had Columbia University Press, which is just the cream of the crop. But I'm trying this one on my own just as an experiment to see how I do without a major marketing arm behind it. And just to see, can my network push this thing? Can my network of people in social media, through my show, whatever reach I have here and there, friends of mine who have me on their shows, how far can I get just on my own? I'm going to be curious to see about that. The book really is a thank you to you guys. You'll notice on the dedication page, it says, to my listeners at tomwoodsradio.com. I really did it. I put it together as a thank you for you guys. And then I thought, well, I might as well release it to the general public. There's no reason not to. So that's what's going on there. I'll keep you posted as we get closer to the date. Speaking of dates, I'm adding another appearance to my schedule. I'm going to be in New York City October 11th, 2014. I'm going to be there for Liberty Fest, New York City, and you can get details on that at, I haven't yet put it up on my website, but it's at LF, that's for Liberty Fest, LFNYC. NYC is New York City, so LFNYC.com. Get details on that. You'll see several Tom Woods Show guests on the roster there. Bob Murphy, Stephen Kinsella, and Scott Horton. And by the way, in the coming months, I've got a big announcement to make about a project I'm hoping to work on with Scott Horton. And if this goes through, it is going to be the most awesome project I have ever been involved in publishing. So stay tuned for that, too. All right, listen, everybody, I hope you enjoy this show. I hope you enjoyed the Q&A thing that I just did. I'll try and do more of these. Submit your questions at tomwoods.com on the contact page. I appreciate the support. Spread the word about the show for me. If you like what I'm doing and you'd like to support me, head over to supportinglisteners.com. I believe this is the week that you're going to start seeing quite a long laundry list of goodies that you get. Particularly the more you support, the more goodies you get. Oh boy, these are some big goodies. I can't wait to tell you about them. All right, thanks so much, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.